Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm Alex.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Benjamin.
And today we are talking about general positioning in War Machine, achieving board-relevant positions in Steamroller 2017, and what areas of the board matter, how to get on them in an effective way, and then from the reverse standpoint, how much do you actually have to give up to maintain relevance in scenario and not give your opponent points that result in a cascading win?
I think that we should go into the first step, which is actually reconsidering list composition now. I noticed that in 2017, a lot of the lists that used to bring a lot of high-value, low-model-count armies have given up way too much advantage on the scenario play. And you really should reconsider some of your list composition in order to make sure that you have scoring models that are both units, solos, and obviously Warbeast slash Jax, which we're going to be around, but, you know, four scoring positions in addition to getting business done.
Right. So the low model count armies that have a low number of modules, we're looking at typically a mix of Jax and battle engines. And those armies can struggle into scenarios that aren't recon and a couple others.
So I would like to go into my little pre-approved rant.
Yeah.
Troll people have been saying since the beginning of Steamroller 2017 that Beast Bricks don't work anymore because you can't hold it. In my experience, that is fundamentally a lie. Circle zones are really obnoxious to score unless you want to put your Warlock up in there. But just contesting, plus the raw amount of solos that you have in Whelps, 5 for 4 points, is amazing for being able to hold flags slash contest zones until you win on attrition. And so I think if you're able to field a brick that can handle sitting in whatever the play space is long enough until you win, you are absolutely fine. You're not going to win on scenario very often, and it'll hurt your SOS tiebreak, or not SOS, CP tiebreaks after SOS, but the game is as playable, if not more so, now that Incursion no longer exists.
So I would like to clarify that he is referring to the troll people as in the troll War Machine and Hordes community, not internet trolls or the hill people with whom we're associated.
There is a fair amount of overlap between those three
communities.
I'm not
saying there isn't. I'm just saying you're specifically calling out a specific subset of the trolls.
Yes. Yep.
So I want to come back to the brick thing because I feel like positionally that's really important. I definitely get your point, though, that like there is a popular sentiment that you can't be taking large battle groups and trolls and have it work.
And I think to a lesser extent, other factions.
Right. Yeah. And I think your actual record with Doomshaper 2 specifically actually testifies that your opinion is correct. But going back to list composition really quickly, something that I experienced at the WTC, which I was not expecting and has really solidified in my mind, is that army composition needs to change from how I've previously been building armies and how I've seen a lot of armies be built in order to play in the way the board works now. You need at least 2 solos bare minimum, and you should probably be targeting somewhere in the area of 4. Some of the scenarios are simply too hard to score without a unit. Not that you're going to win on it, but you need to be making points. So you probably need some unit presence. And then, and this is where I really want to get going. The scenario setup for SR17 and the way you have to deploy and move your army forces your army to go, or it favors wider formations than it previously did. Like having elements of your army really far apart from each other, especially for scoring close scenario geometry, like in Spread the Net, or very distant flags. Yeah, so armies...
Yeah, Spread the Net is by far the worst example out of all of them. Because in most of the others, you can basically hold the scenario in roughly a 6x12 area. Like, if you look at it, there's basically a 6x12 area that if you hold, you're not going to lose on scenario. But Spread the Net, it's like a 12x18 box that you need to, like, hold some amount in. And it is a nightmare if you don't have the raw solos to handle it with a brick.
Mm-hmm. And also, to point out, because some people won't necessarily articulate this, those solos need to be not your support solos as well, because otherwise, if you are, for example, like in Signar, I have this problem all the time. I have Strangeways, right, who's a fantastic support solo. But there'll be days where I realize that he needs to jog his suboptimal speed Heine over to something, and I'm effectively giving him up as a useful piece in order just to park him on a flag because I need the solo. And that changes the list design a lot, because he's not a contesting piece, but sometimes I really need him to be. And so you're really looking for solos that are either super cheap that you can throw in there, or have some tenacity so they're harder to remove from those positions.
Yep. Inbuilt defensive abilities are really strong, especially stealth on solos with guns.
Yeah, I would say...
Or Gremlin Swarms.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Gremlin Swarms are like the standout version of that right now. They have both incorporeal and stealth, which puts them in a phenomenal category for being a contesting slash scoring piece.
And right. For 3 points, they're a freaking steal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
free.
The flip side to taking close flags and zones is you also really need to be able to effectively contest in a lasting way far zones and flags, which was not as big a deal in previous steamrollers, excepting perhaps the pit in 16. So what this looks like, I think in previous dynamics of the game that we'd all become very accustomed to over a relatively stable steamroller for about 4 years, is the most critical and essential portions of the board were about an 18-inch diameter circle in the middle of the board. Almost all the board-relevant positions were contained in that circle, because your ability to threat out of that area extends to pretty much any other portion of the board. And you can threat into that area, like, from anywhere in it. If you're outside of that area, the amount of the board that you can influence is, you know, really limited to basically just the things that you're on the side of. It was also the case in previous Steamroller that almost all of the scenario geometry, or at least a large portion of the area to contest or control, was located inside that 18-inch circle. It's now the case on every scenario except for Recon that the area of the board that's relevant to scenario for the bulk of contesting and controlling is now significantly wider on the horizontal axis. It's probably about 24 to 30 inches wide on most scenarios now, with Recon being the one big exception. That's the area where you can contest effectively from there, you can control effectively from there, and you need to be projecting threat out that far. Do you guys have anything on that?
Not specifically on the geometry, but the fact that it's now delta points instead of a goal means that in the whole seven turns thing, because, I mean, most games were basically over by, like, turn three or four, and I mean, I guess they still are. But being able to eke out an advantage multiple turns because your opponent hasn't committed as much is huge value.
It has now moved it from you accomplish an objective, you score the number of points, and you move on to a different position, to now you are committing to and attempting to hold positions for an extended period of time, and those positions are farther out from each other than they've been in the past.
And also, kind of like as a more recent trend, solo scalpels are becoming way more valuable right now. It used to be in Mark II when you had a lot of high-value solos like Iris, Orin, etc. It was super important to have some way of being able to just, nope, they're gone. In the middle, like before Steamroller 2017, and like in the early theme of Palooza, as it were, it was more about brick value. And so you didn't really see recently this need to just have an ability to just say, no, that solo is gone. And that's really important now. If you aren't willing to get all the way over to their close flag, you need to be able to at least get rid of whatever's standing on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, where what's also changed is that the high-value solos used to be get business solos.
Yeah, they used now, to do things. Now right. they just sit places.
Right, and that's a huge change because you're not looking at killing a solo because it's a threat in the sense that it's killing your pieces or doing something else. You need to kill it because if you don't kill it, you lose on scenario, which is a weird metric change because you still need a scalpel piece, but you're not trying to save your cast. You're just trying to keep scoring from happening.
Yeah.
But it does give you more options in what your scalpel pieces look like because they don't need to be as sort of over the top, which means if you're not getting for free, you can pick some sort of mid-level solos which get business done without necessarily being at a premium.
Yeah, you're also, I've noticed, tending to favor autonomous pieces for a variety of reasons, one of them being the huge spread. Models that take a disproportionate amount of effort to kill on their own, Gremlin Swarms, Marksmen, any solo that can score a flag and not die, with some stuff that leans pretty heavily into not dying becomes really valuable because they can do a little bit of work and not die, and they're achieving value.
Right. Also, certain units have also come back into the fore because of that, because some smaller, cheap, but you know, either CRA or CMA units actually become quite valuable for pulling out some of those contesting solos, because you can get up there, get some work done without having to worry about supporting them, per se, because their target profile means that their standard abilities are perfectly fine.
And they don't require centralized support either from another piece or your caster, which is important, again, because of the spread and how far away your things can be away from each other. And also because of terrain, which I want to get to later.
Yeah.
Yeah. In general, in Steamroller 2017, it feels like your Warcaster / Warlock's control bubble. It feels a lot smaller than it used to in Steamroller 2016, in mm-hmm. my experience. You feel the pain of it a lot more.
Yeah.
What's also interesting, because it actually devalues some of the control feats a fair amount as well, because some of the hard control feats, because of the smaller area and the fact that scoring's happening outside of their control, suddenly became less game-dictating than they used to be. But it's also improved some other feats that give you, you know, like a curve advantage in removal, because those feats became stronger if you can reach out and touch people and just take pieces off, meaning that you suddenly start controlling the scoring rhythm better. Or feats, of course, that just keep you from losing things. That's always good.
Yeah. Well, the trick with defensive feats is if you aren't going first, they lose a lot of value.
But it's also, it's interesting, though, because it has shifted, at least in my list builds, towards casters that also offer more consistent support versus casters that have a whammy feat. Because if the caster gets more work done turn over turn, it helps with your positioning. It helps with keeping the scoring geometry alive. And I find that those casters are bringing more value, because if you have something that allows your units to either move out of activation, get an extra bonus activation, or move through things, you can suddenly get a scoring advantage or stop a scoring advantage from happening in a meaningful manner.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think probably the knee plus ultra for control feats now is dictating scoring in a localized area. Like, we've set it up that scoring is not going to happen over here, and I'm going to get a bunch of points in this one area.
Right, and, you know, again, it keeps showing that why Haley 2 is so good is because she has multiple tools for ensuring scoring. And even if you flipped away from assassination entirely, which is actually pretty common now with her, the TKs, the slowdowns, like all the options you get with her still create many options to get scores off that otherwise you wouldn't get.
Mm-hmm.
And any caster that has that level of control can do that. Like Thexis, for example, can play a very, very strong scoring scenario game.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. As far as like positioning, you know, we've talked about covering the horizontal spread, like being able to do denial and have autonomous elements. Have you guys noticed like any change as far as vertical spread? In my experience, you know, accepting spread the net, like the game critical areas of the board seem to have narrowed on the vertical axis. Spread the net and
standoff.
I would say a lot of that seems to depend more on the fact that there's buildings in the center nowadays or a forest in the center. Because I've noticed with a lot of casters that used to be very sort of not get near the front at all, if you have a building or a forest just simply be on the other side of that's more central, you tend to move up to take advantage of that. And I've noticed a lot of those casters end up further up than they used to be, but they're still not necessarily in any more danger than they were before.
Mm-hmm. Magnus is a prime example of that. He's been popping up a lot recently from what I've seen, and he is obnoxious when you can't get LOS to him and he's effectively in the middle of the board.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the same thing. Like, I remember a game I played recently where, you know, I was able to move my caster up behind a building and sit there all game. And, you know, there was no disadvantage to it. And that's reliable into a lot of the scenarios now because people are supposed to be putting that train there. And it does change that matchup a lot. I've also, of course, had very frustrating games into people who parked their caster behind something and I literally couldn't get to it all game.
Tying into the Magnus thing and the scenarios being narrower vertically, I think that's very important, again, for casters with powerful control feats is saying, okay, scoring's not happening over here. Lots of scoring is happening here right now. Is because to get to contest, like, the area where the game is played, where points are scored, and where models need to threaten to, across, and from, has become both wider horizontally and narrow vertically. If you can pass that area, you can effectively shut your opponent out of scenario completely, and it is significantly easier to get past it because the edge that you have to pass is much closer to you. This creates a lot of lockout games and makes being very fast very important.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if you're not the one going first is what sets up the dynamic of the meat grinder. Going second, I have to now start pitching pieces in from turn one onward.
And actually, speaking specifically to standoff and spread the net, the two most vertical of them, those rectangular zones on your opponent's half of the board are some of the most difficult things to effectively stop. Because mm-hmm. it's pretty easy to just put a line of beasts where you have one barely towing into each circle, and then you have stuff in your rectangular zone. But throwing stuff into your opponent's rectangular zone is very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have low, high quality models. You don't really have anything you can throw away in there. So unless you're going to send your entire force so deep into your opponent that they can't undo all of it, you're effectively throwing away like a fifth of your army just to stop them scoring, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's certain casters that also are very good at a bunker, and if they're sitting on one of those squares, there's basically nothing you can do without just literally giving them free points indefinitely until you're out of free points to give them.
Yep.
And that can be very frustrating. And then you have to make that decision. Is it worth contesting for that one point? Or do you just accept that you're giving up a point a turn? You're claiming a point a turn, and then you're trying to get points out of one of the circles.
Yeah. Yeah. Mark, earlier you mentioned bricks, and I think this is something that I've seen is the way an army moves in terms of overall formation. And I know you use the term brick to refer to a caster with a large battle group, not really a very big unit contingent in the army, and mostly it's war beasts offensively covering each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways I've seen armies move. One is they move to spread out to cover the entire area where the game is played, and then, like, you know, basically manufacture overlapping threat ranges across the entire play area of the board. Previously, about an 18-inch circle in the center of the board, now about like a 24 to 30 inch wide by, you know, 10 to 12 inch deep rectangle in the middle of the board. So some armies will spread out and manufacture overlapping threat ranges. There will be a lot of space between models and a lot of room for movement across that space. But basically everything's covering each other. And then there's armies that, for reasons of defensive synergy or because of the shortness of threat ranges or whatever, have to cluster very tightly on a small area.
So I think defensive bricks are objectively bad right now.
I agree 100%. And one of the things I spotted in my own play, something that definitely hurt me at the WTC, I was running an army that had a defensive brick at its core. And when you see those two movement styles, like where an army clusters very tightly to maintain an effective formation versus, and in the same game, the opposing army spreads out to cover the entire playing area, I can guarantee you in virtually every instance of that, the army that spreads is winning and is going to win.
Yeah, especially for the melee bricks. If you're able to get to a threat projection level where your model's threat greater than the dimensions of each zone, if you park one in a zone, your opponent literally can't put anything in there that they aren't willing to let die.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter what quality model is going away. So stuff like Kray, Doom Shaper, Amon's a little bit short of it at 11 inches, but you can just play a little bit further forwards, and hopefully your denial effects with the choir are enough to compensate for those extra couple of inches that you have to play forwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I really want to draw the distinction on, like, specifically the Doom Shaper list you've been playing, and then, like, to a lesser extent, Gunnbjorn lists that kind of pop up more or less in most troll players' lineups at this point. What your Doom Shaper army is doing is not the tight cluster.
No.
Like, I've observed your army routinely spreads to typically around 14 to 16 inches from end to end of your formation. And your models, because they have a threat range extender, almost all their threat ranges overlap across each other. And when you actually move into formation, you threat the extent of the playing zone of the game.
Yeah, so specifically with Doom Shaper, so for those who are unfamiliar with the list, it's Mulg, Double Earthborn, Double Mauler, Axer, Creel Stone with the UA, Janissa, two sets of whelps. Though, after the Troll CID, Rune Bear is probably going to make it in there, so you can have the 16-inch agitation bubble. Cash money. What tends to happen is you'll split things up, where the Earthborns tend to cluster together because they synergize with specific terrain elements. And since, if those aren't super abundant on the board from your unpacking area, they tend to go to the same spot roughly together. You'll put a Mauler on the same flank with them, and then you'll put Mulg and a Mauler on the other flank. And you'll spread out such that your Creel Stone can hang far enough back that you aren't going to be threatened by any of their scalpels, and you're going to cover all of them with the aura. And you're going to sit there, and it's like, you either don't tow anything into the zone, or I hit you so hard your head spins, because all of those models threaten 14 to 16 inches, depending on whether everything threatens 14, the Earthborn threatens 16, they're near rough terrain. So if I'm towing into a zone, there's literally nowhere you can hide from me. And LOS isn't a problem because their trample threat's the same as their charge threat. Kray works a little bit less well in that scenario because he requires being able to charge or slam, I believe, for his speed ability.
Yeah, he does.
Arcadius has a very similar problem. There's a lot of boundless charge casters in bricks that have similar issues where their threat is predicated on having LOS to the target, which isn't necessarily always the case, especially because you're going to have LOS blocking the center. So if there's a central zone, you can sometimes have difficulties getting all the way through that. I mean, if it's a house, I'm as screwed as anybody else. But if it's a forest, I just trample through with Pathfinder and I'm getting to you.
Yeah. The actual threat ranges of the army is very important, and that not just that it can charge you from a long way away, but that it can charge all board relevant positions you can assume is really important. And I think, like, would you guys like say it's fair to say that being fast is the most important thing in War Machine right now?
Well, threat projection. I don't want to say being fast because gun lines can work in a very similar way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. It's threat projection, because, I mean, you know, spellcasters can, you know, you can, it's the ability to project threat across the middle line immediately, which is the most important part, whether it's by moving your infantry or beasts at an incredibly fast pace or having a gun line projection that clearly cuts across that.
Right. And the line you need to project past is closer than it's ever been before.
Right.
Yeah. I think guns are in a pretty good spot right now. Maybe a bit on the good side. I don't know what their specific, like, faction-to-faction matchups are with particular lists, but just the concept of being able to tow gunjacks, gunbeasts, whatever, into zones, threaten the entirety of the zone, and not have to send your model in to clear stuff is very valuable. It works great for scalping solos on flags. It works great for just keeping zones clear. The downside, of course, being you don't hit as hard as a melee option.
Right. I guess I'm really skeptical of that, partially because of my, like, Kador experience, and I can totally get, like, somebody who plays a lot of Protectorate having a very opposite experience, because the two things you need to make that work in the current environment, like, to guaranteed have it work and your opponent can't just stall you or deny you, is stealth removal and magic weapons. If you don't have those, you can't do it viably.
Yeah.
And, like, you need both.
Yes.
Well, thankfully, the Merc Edition makes that a lot easier now.
Yeah.
And Signar is swimming in all those good times.
Yeah. Returning to composition really quickly, like, that's something that's, and just thinking on the Kador experience, that's something that's really important, because your composition needs to go to generally 2 to 4 to more solos and some unit component and a battle group that can actually function on attrition and close a game out if you need to. Your army needs to be so large to be effective on SR17 at this point that I think it's rarely viable not to play a theme force just because of the needs of composition.
Oh, of course. And this was definitely Privateer Press's intention.
Well, and not even just from a points, like, I have, you know, 120 something point army to your 108 point army or whatever it is, just like,
just the ability to get solos out of it is massive.
Yeah, yeah. I think the raw number of pieces you now need to play the game is significantly higher, and if you are not playing a theme force, there had better be a really compelling reason why.
Thorned gun mages?
I would say no. I would say that seems like an incredible mistake, but I would agree. I mean, I've definitely found with, again, going back to my Signar example at the moment, like, heavy metal has definitely flipped in being a phenomenal theme force for Signar to suddenly being problematic in that the only units you can actually take are
the mechanics
and the blade guys, the knight dudes.
Can't you sword also knights take, and precursors. Can you take a merc unit? Can you take the bellows crew?
Not in War Machine.
No.
Oh, I thought Signar could take them.
No. God, I wish.
They can take Tinker, but not in that list. They can't right. have Merc Solos.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm 100% positive.
They can have a Merc Battle Engine.
Which is weird. And don't.
I distinctly remember playing against Zach playing Striker with a Swamp Gobber Bellows crew.
He did not have a Swamp Gobber Bellows crew. I can assure you that you were thinking of something else.
Well, this is a discussion that's getting cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. As we meander through our half-formed memories and...
Hey, I drank a lot last night.
Uh-huh. Getting back on topic, it definitely has changed the balance of the themes, because giving you free solos is great and basically mandatory, but making sure you have units for scoring is also super critical. Like for example, my Kane 3 list, which I was very happy with, has completely broken down into scenario play now. Like, mm-hmm. It simply doesn't work. It's murder threat still as strong as it ever was.
Right, the threat projection is good, but the position they're projecting from is now very bad for them.
Right, because I simply do not have the ability to score. And especially into Spread the Net, which is the most live scoring one, if I don't have the option of putting a unit into both zones, I am effectively ceding a lot of the game to my opponent, which is a big problem.
Yeah.
Can we just retitle this episode Spread the Net was a gigantic design mistake?
We could.
I'm also a personal fan of Spread the Cheeks.
Yeah.
That's a different design philosophy.
Yeah, I think
just don't like options.
I think you're dead on about that the Kane 3 problem there.
Yeah, I mean it's solvable if you go into a different theme, essentially, but it completely changes the Kane murder jack line into something very different, which I don't think is bad for game balance, but it's definitely something you have to look at when you're building your list.
As a troll player, I don't mind at all.
Well, so, I mean, it is changing the theme balance, though. For example, because the area you have to pass to be in total control of scenario is closer than ever before, +1 to go first, because you are going to go first, and +2 inches to deployment zone are probably now the most powerful theme benefits I can think of.
Yeah.
Well, now that they've gotten rid of no AD, that was insane in the right matchups.
Yeah, it was irrelevant a lot of the time and a pretty ball-busting advantage some of the time.
Yeah, I'd have to say that those themes went from being good in certain matchups to being garbage 100% of the time, though. The fact that they took away removal of AD and then replaced it with no ambushers, which is not even remotely equivalent. And they gave them nothing else.
So it was Ravens and Jaws, right?
Yeah.
Jaws, I think, is good enough on just like raw models to stand on its own still.
Jaws of the Wolf is one of the few Kador... It is like the Kador theme force, the only one that actually has build versatility. The problem is you're limited by Kador jacks, and you have like a mixed bag of unit and solo offerings.
Yeah, I mean, for Ravens, I mean, it basically made that the most pointless theme in the world.
Well, now that it can take Hellmouths,
Ravens can't.
I think it can with the change.
Ravens can now.
Yeah. Oh, it can.
It was part of the update.
Okay.
I think there might be room there. It depends on how viable the Ogryn theme is, I think. Because that's the other one that really incentivizes you to take Hellmouths. Because you get plus 2 inches to deploy, and you can take them as freebies for taking Ogryn. So if Ginger Meat Mountain comes back, you won't see Ravens. But if the Ogryn are just so bad that they are actually unplayable, I think Ravens has room just on virtue of Hellmouths.
Honestly, I think Ogryn's... we'll see a big comeback because, first of all, a lot of Legion players, and this is totally off topic now.
Yeah, we're really far afield.
Yeah, sorry.
So I'm just going to cancel that.
Where were we on scenario positioning?
We were talking about how Spread the Net is the most dynamic and wonderful scenario ever produced by Privateer Press for Steamroller Packet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Theme benefits, adding to deployment and adding to go first. Yeah, because the game is now fought on a really... really wide and vertically narrow strip of space. If you can pass that line, you can seize total control of the game and shut your opponent out of scenario to the point where they have to start, you know, they're clearing themselves, and every turn they have to get enough clear that they can feed something into the meat grinder to not lose immediately on scenario, which I know something is you guys were very eager to talk about, like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, it makes an interesting choice when you're looking at what you have to give up, because ideally you feed in a person from a unit of which you have multiple people, hoping that that one sacrifice, you know, buys you the time you need.
Right. But typically it's only going to buy you one turn of no scoring, because your opponent will clear it and get their turn.
Well, so if you're doing that, you're planning on getting an attritional victory. It's the same way that bricks are still functional now, or offensive bricks, just to harken back to earlier in the episode. If you're able to delay them for a turn or two until you're able to mostly table them, then that's fine. You just need to make sure that they have no way to be able to score out to 5+ on any given turn. And if you're able to ensure that until you are positioned in such a way that you're going to win on the board on just taking pieces off the board until they have nothing that they can do to you, then you're great.
Right.
Also, it comes down to deciding whether you're sacrificing a piece for just that turn, but not every turn, or whether this is like a constant state on one side of the board or not.
And, also for recursion lists,
right.
Like losing the model doesn't matter. So you're just giving them a point every turn, but you're not losing anything for doing it.
Because that comes up a lot where if you're about to sort of sweep aside and then put yourself in high position for scoring on one side of it, sometimes you just throw a model away on the other side to just keep them from getting too on parity with you on scoring. And that's sometimes the right decision, but... if you don't have the depth of models to keep throwing things in there, that's kind of like a one-off or like maybe a two-turn solution just to keep them from staying right even with you on scoring until you start getting, you know, a scenario pull. And that certainly, you know, comes up a lot more with some of the, like, you know, offensive bricks, because sometimes you just need to throw something over there and suck it up so that you can keep them from getting up on points while you clear the other side.
Right. Yeah, you're going to win once the game goes long enough. You need to never give them an out to scenario.
Right.
And this is where the losing at list selection pops in, because if you have an army that can not only project threat past the play space, but can get past it, and you don't have like the ability to actually decisively crush them on attrition and then take back the scenario advantage, you're definitely going to lose. Yeah. Unless like do something crazy. That's actually one of the big areas where your Doomshaper 2 army really succeeds. Is it does that. Because all the components are really hard to kill.
Yeah, yes. Well, that's the same reason that I've had a lot of success with my current Striker 2 build, is for the same reason, is that I have a large front of pieces that get a lot of work done, plus I have the ability to swing attrition really hard in the center of the table where Striker is, and puts me in a position where I'm not really going to be down on either side of that scoring unless I've done something wrong. And that's the kind of list you need, though, because I have scoring options across the board, though, because I have heavies, I have a light, I have two units of infantry, I have a bunch of solos. Like, it gives me all the choices I could need. And I also have an attrition game. And unfortunately, a lot of the Signar lists before that one weren't filling in enough of those checkboxes. And so I was definitely, even if I had an attrition game, I didn't have the breadth of scoring to keep myself competitive, and I'd lose on scoring to somebody. Even though I was winning the attrition game, and in some of them I just wasn't fast enough. Like, I couldn't get into position quickly enough to be relevant. And sometimes with a shooting game too, you get that position where if you don't happen to murder enough stuff with the shooting, you suddenly find yourself really behind quickly on the scoring game. You know, and obviously not to focus too much on faction-specific issues, but, you know, like, that's part of the planning. Because all the factions run into this, where you have to give and take between what you're bringing to the table for both scenario versus attrition versus murder assassination.
Right. Yeah. And something I'm getting out of this conversation is, it's, you know, based on what we're all saying, it doesn't really seem possible to break the clustered formation at a play level in SR17. And it's definitely something you need to be working on an army composition level, because you'll get boned if you're the guy who's clustering every time and your opponent is, you know, full liberty of movement spreading and seizing ground.
At the very least on the scenario, if you have some way to brick up and be like, if you can't take down enough of these pieces, I'm going to kill you, then I think it still works.
Right. But, and that's a serious beatdown play and creating forced errors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the real difference also has been that with the changes in Mark III, assassination has been weirder in its reliability. Because it used to be in Mark II that you could, like, assassination casters had a certain number of ultra-reliable combinations they were firing off repeatedly. And even though there's some very strong assassination casters in Mark III, I feel like their reliability, because of the fact that scoring has shifted so dramatically, has dropped off massively. Because if a person can keep their caster even remotely safe, and you're really pushing for assassination, you're going to lose on scenario almost every time.
I think also themes changed it. Between Winter Guard Command, Destruction Initiative, and Forges of War.
Oh yeah, completely shifted.
There's like three factions that you just will not be able to kill. Full stop, if you're playing a gunline assassination.
So wait, Forges of War is Convergence, right?
No, that's Retribution. Shield Guard the list.
No, what's the Convergence also has a list.
Destruction.
Okay, that's the one, yeah, sorry.
So I'd like to do a bit of a hard pivot and start talking about terrain and how that's also affecting positioning in SR17, because it's not just the scenario geometry. We talked about, like, casters will get dragged forward and they are frequently safe.
Yeah, the biggest difference is the placing of a building or obstruction in the center of the table.
Yeah, a line of sight blocking terrain. So, right. Like a fog bank, an obstruction, a forest.
Whoa.
Fog banks starting to catch on?
I've never seen a fog bank.
Almost no one plays them. They were there at the WTC.
Yeah, weird. But
I think there might have been some at Crucible, but...
Well, let's not ever forget those Burning Hills and Iron Gauntlet. Woo, woo!
Yeah. Oh, my God. Those triggered me so hard. Thankfully, nobody was playing Vlad 2.
Yeah.
I removed the hill.
I'm still waiting to see somebody make a Burning Wall, which is an LOS blocking wall. Hmm. That even if you have True Sight, it's still a wall.
So the biggest play around issue I've been seeing is either that forest or the building in the center of the table, because it allows...
In or near the center of the table.
Right. It allows you to move up your caster and support in a way that normally you couldn't before, because you can pretty much guarantee it's going to be there. And it's one of those things where previous to 2017, some boards would have sometimes something like that, and you'd be kind of like, oh, that's a weird thing to account for. But in 2017, it's literally there every game. You're like, okay, there's an obstruction and or a forest right there. I got to do something with it.
Yeah, it's the new world order.
Right.
And I love it.
Yeah.
And it just takes, that's again where assassination casters have really dropped off as well, is that if you just can't get line of sight, your assassination vectors just don't trigger.
Right. Yeah, there's something, you're absolutely right in that it tends to let the back of the army move forward in ways that it had not been able to previously. I've noticed that there's, due to following the terrain guidelines, there are basically only two kinds of tables now. Like, the kind of terrain you will see is actually really formulaic, and knowing how to play on those two kinds of boards is really important. I would not say, like, as important as going first, but, like, the kind of terrain you're going to play onto is predictable and will have a consistent game dynamic. The two board types that are set up that actually matter, we're talking terrain in the area of the board that matters, that like 24 to 30 inch by 12 inch strip. The two kinds of boards you will see is single line of sight blocking terrain piece in the middle. And that's the big thing in the game, is navigating around that and causing a split in your army, because it's usually close enough to the center to cause you to split, or asymmetrical bottleneck, where there is the central line of sight blocking terrain and another piece of line of sight blocking terrain on either player's half of the board.
Sometimes on both players' half of the board, and then it's just symmetrical multiple bottlenecks.
Right. So Those are the two types of boards you see with any regularity in SR17.
I actually prefer the consistency of how SR17 has like standardized terrain. It makes me feel comfortable in building a game plan around, like, I don't feel like the board's ever going to randomly screw me.
Yeah, I really appreciate the consistency, and I hate that those are the two kinds of boards you have, and that's it. So they enforce. I was alluding to this earlier, talking about favoring autonomous units and models. Because one of the terrain pieces is always going to be in the center of the board, your army is going to have to put on typically 6 to 8 inches of split somewhere toward the middle. So you're going to have some pieces that it will not be possible to move laterally and support unless you are way past the middle of the board. And they just have to operate on their own and manage that half of the board. And they can't support the other part of the army. If you've got an asymmetrical bottleneck, it tends to split your army into three or force you to cluster, and you just get shut out because the area is too wide. So what the effect of this is, and is like probably the biggest reason I say Warhammer Fantasy was a tactically shallow game, is with that terrain setup in place, unless you are moving completely past it, if you have to maneuver around it and engage around it, your army is just going straight forward and fighting the thing that deployed directly across from it with little to no lateral movement or positioning. So that's also a fairly regular constant in the game now. Versus what you no longer see at all is open centered tables, where lateral movement between elements of your army and rapidly positioning side to side used to be very important. That dynamic basically doesn't exist anymore, unless you're, a very fortunate army like Vyros 2, where the center of the table is open to only you.
There's also, it creates an interesting situation with a lot of casters now, where you used to have to keep essentially like a bodyguard bubble with a lot of casters in the older scenario setups, because there was conditions about things, you know, either getting line of sight to you or simply, you know, the threat just getting to you from a side or, you know, through the center. Whereas now with some of the more supporty casters, you can just be behind that thing essentially at zero risk forever. And you can also spend more resources and have that bubble, instead of being a defensive bubble, be out there getting work done. which changes some of the list dynamics a fair amount because you can rely on that caster not needing to be constantly in its own little protection bubble.
Also, I think some of the control casters encourage lateral, better lateral choices, but they're kind of getting oppressed a little bit. Not a ton, but they're not as dominant as they were.
How do you mean they actually encourage lateral choices?
If they prevent you from... So, in particular, stuff like Haley, stuff like Magnus.
Oh, they prevent you from repositioning laterally.
Denny, to a lesser extent, when she's playing more of a control game.
Or when she's going first and targeting a scenario win.
Planning out your lateral moves and understanding that you're going to need to potentially compensate if something goes south is very valuable into those matchups, and you don't necessarily see that in the attrition. Though I think there's a number of lists in the game that just don't care about terrain. They go really far, mm-hmm. or they threaten really far, and so they can shift. So Doomy, Vyros, Amon.
Yeah.
These are lists that fleet. If they need to just shunt over one way. Well, Ghost Fleet actually has a bit of a hard time with rough terrain.
I mean, you've got... you've got access to Ghost Walk, which is not ubiquitous, and you often want to be doing other things with your focus, and that army maintains a pretty big spread.
Yeah.
But I think they handle it better than most. And obviously, the biggest way to mitigate this, the terrain effect, is to just move past it, which involves seizing a winning position. But... booking laterally, there is another effect of the big terrain in the middle, which is swings on either of the flanks because of the increased difficulty of moving over there or supporting over there. Any swing or if someone suddenly gets a leg up on that flank, it tends to become permanent.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if that's necessarily a feature of the center being blocked up. If I crush a flank,
it's a function of having to split and being almost totally unable to support or move over there.
Yeah, so by denying just super defensive bricks, it makes crushing a flank work.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue that I'm seeing though is recovering from it for a lot of lists is really hard, especially because the elements of their army need to be further apart.
Yeah, but if you tend to crush a flank, at least in my experience, when you crush a flank, you're killing everything on that flank and everything that threatens into that flank. So basically, you've got your right half and your left half, if you're thinking about it split in those terms. Mm-hmm. Your right half kills their right half. Your left half kills their middle, so that there's no way for you to get in on the right. And you kill what was my left half and is now kind of in your center, but you are unable to progress past that into the right half that I have just dominated.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, yeah, we're thinking of different dynamics, because like what I'm picturing in my head is, you know, okay, we've both made a shallow commitment to my left-hand flank. We've got asshole skirmishers versus asshole skirmishers, and my asshole skirmishers actually happen to get some really good dice and killed all of yours, and there's a forest between your center and my asshole skirmishers. Those asshole skirmishers are never going away now.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be there forever.
Yeah, there's a bit of a problem with pocket forests in general. I think there's a lot of places that you'll go to where forests are too big, and they're positioned in such a way that there's some way to hold something meaningfully without being able to get on them, unless you ignore forests.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one thing I've noticed with some of the infantry unit value, was that I've noticed when I was playing some of the new units that either had some survivability or had a longer range skirmish, that I would just go peel all the way to the outside and start scoring over there. And it was really, really hard for somebody to get something useful over there. They could end up putting a piece into contest, but they never really got rid of that unit. And it became a problem for my opponent. Like, for example, the new Trencher Commandos, for example, which Trencher Commandos, though I've loved the models forever, have been trash for as long as I've owned them. And all of a sudden, the fact that they have stealth and actually outmatch most of the infantry that does what they do put them in a really interesting scoring position for the outside circles, especially if you are continuing to hold the outside part of it.
Yeah, it definitely puts value into things that can tear through infantry without caring about stealth.
Mm-hmm.
Sprays, they don't dig in, so you can blast them, right? So if you've got like sprays or blasts or just natively ignore stealth and you can get a high volume of fire over there, you're fine. Otherwise, you're going to need to allocate something over there.
And it comes down to them being price point relevant, because there's a lot of units now that you want them cheaper because they just need to do a function into other cheaper units without necessarily being your game swingers. But now you begin to really start needing something like that to be competitive into some of the further scenarios.
Right, and that's another big composition shift where autonomy on models and units, because they're going to be alone, unsupported, strongly favoring defensive autonomy becomes a really big deal.
I'm actually really interested to see when the Northkin Bears come out.
Mm-hmm.
Ambushing things that are tough instead of not, but a low model count. I'm wondering... I mean, I haven't played with them because I really don't like playing with things until they're out. I'm wondering if they're in such a way that they will be sufficiently obnoxious for people to deal with on the flanks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they might not have good targets ambushing in, because you probably don't just randomly have a heavy within, what's it, it's like 14 inches of the board edge or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes you do.
You sometimes do, but it's not like they live or die on being able to hit that target. But, I mean, there's still a pretty tanky unit that's coming in from your side, maybe just running to engage your support, and the game goes really badly for you if you have to allocate something to go deal with that that is actually capable of dealing with that.
Well, I will say that Joe Claudel has been, for a lack of other options that he had available, has been playing with a Trollkin Skinner recently in one of his lists. And the much-derided Trollkin Skinner, with ambush, has proven to be actually a huge pain in the arse to deal with for contesting, because they actually have a pretty good defensive profile, especially if there's a forest, and then they're super hard to remove. They aren't personally scary, but they're... what do you do with them? Like, they continue to either block up or score almost forever over there.
I really wish they had kept... So, at the end of Mark II... they got put in a Madrag 1 theme, I believe, where they got Beacon. Mm. I think if they had just kept that for Mark 3, you would be seeing a lot more of them.
Yeah, I will say, though, that the fact that they get plus 2 defense against every attack while in a forest, and the fact that they have tough, puts them in a very interesting position as far as getting rid of them. And they actually kill other infantry reasonably well. And if you do get a charge off and get against a beast, they can actually be super, super crit swingy.
Yep.
But it's just interesting to see a piece like that. Like, I wouldn't have given it the time of day until I saw it into these new scenarios. And I'm like, hey, wait, that's actually a very interesting piece for just, like, you can sort of give up that side to strengthen your other side. And that Troll Skinner comes in and you're like, okay, that's a pain in the arse. Like, he's contesting until I actually put something that does real work over there.
He also scores, or threatens to score your opponent's flag on Spread the Net, which is a huge coup.
A huge, yeah. It's a massive advantage for that piece.
On a related note, like, I have a Signar army. I'm not playing it actively right now. If I was, I would be right now in SR17 looking for room in every single list to add Anastasia Debray.
Oh, mm-hmm. She's insane.
She's an ambusher. She can score distant flags. She can contest in a pinch, which is really important. And it's 3 points for plus one to go first.
And the backstab on that knife means she is an amazing scalpel.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
If you need some solo or support model dead, it's going away with like 90% accuracy.
Yeah.
She'll
kill the guy taking the flag and then score it herself later on.
Look at me. I'm on the flag now.
Yeah.
Well, and Signar players... Anastasia Debray in Gravediggers gives you plus 2 to go first on a principally AD army. What?
Yeah, no, actually,
Gravediggers can't take Merc solos because they only do subsets now, right? I think it's not every faction gets solo and unit and battle engine. It's like depending.
Gravediggers is one of the ones that you can take a Merc solo in.
Okay,
you can actually take a Merc solo. The weird subset one. Some of them tag non character. Ah. Which is really weird.
Right.
So
Gravediggers can't take character merc units, but you can take, with the changes, I believe...
No, they're mercenary solo and one mercenary unit.
Right.
They can be character.
Oh, they actually added back character units now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I did make a very interesting Gravediggers list with her, and I am going to be trying that out after we're done with the I-5 stuff, because... I think actually Striker 2 and a Gravedigger's List provides a much stronger presence for Signar, because it doesn't break as much armor, but its scenario denial is there for the entire game, which is actually strong in and of itself.
All right. Do we have any closing comments on this one?
I think we've covered the gamut here. Terrain, yep. The importance of solos, knowing when to feed things.
Change in army composition, what parts of the board matter.
Offensive bricks versus defensive bricks.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that you need to project into the entirety of the play area if you want to be able to keep up / get ahead.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good look at the topic.
Okay, well, until next time.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea? Email us at dominateforto.podcast@gmail.com. We'll be right back.